lot of work, okay? You have to organize the guests, you have to do a Google Calendar, and you build a following. It takes a long fucking time, and I've been working on it for a while.
Pod, a 32 Fans podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester.
And my name is John Gilpatrick. And today we are going to be talking about the movies of December 2022, but also some November, October, September, etc., as we play end of year catch up in our technically first episode of 2023. Sammy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. In true There Will Be Pod fashion, didn't maybe get to arguably the biggest of December's new movies. I guess that would be, what, Avatar 2. I didn't see Babylon yet. And I also didn't see Women Talking. I don't know if all three of those are also misses for you. You know, maybe we'll try to catch up and do a special mini episode in January to hit some of those bigger names from December. But as you mentioned, between catching up on past months and this generally being a very end-heavy year, I saw, I think, 16 movies this month, new releases, and almost all of them were great. The opposite of top heavy. It's a very bottom heavy year. And therefore, there was a lot to like in December, even without maybe a Damien Chazelle or an Avatar 2.
If we do end up seeing Babylon in theaters, we might single-handedly double its box office.
Yeah.
While seeing Avatar is going to be a drop in all the oceans.
Drop in the oceans of Pandora, yeah.
That's time of year where, you know, not only do the movies start getting better, but it's the one month a year where my wife is kind of paying some attention to what's being released.
I will see a few movies with my wife over the course of the year, though she'll generally fall asleep within 5 to 10 minutes of watching them. So she only sees the first 10 minutes of most movies we watch together. But when it gets to like December, January, one of the things on my head is always, okay, of movies I either want to see or movies I've already seen and I would consider rewatching because she hasn't seen them, which are the ones that I either will most appreciate a rewatch or a watch, uh-huh, and which ones will she most like? And what it does for me is it helps me crystallize be what I consider like the five best movies of the year, because those are the five I really want to share with her. So for instance,
yeah,
a movie that, you know, I know we'll speak about shortly, Banshees of Inisherin, that's a movie that I saw without her. I think she fell asleep again in the first 5 minutes. And that's a movie I know I want to like rewatch with her just because there's a lot there that I want to like revisit, but I also want to share that,
yeah,
with her. So, you know, whether it's a close friend or a romantic partner or whatnot, that becomes your sort of touch case for what is really worth watching together, I think is really helpful, particularly this end of the year. Speaking about this a bit in the group, mm-hmm, whether you're more of a end of the year catch up or whether you're see at release. And a bit of context there, through our late great podcast host, Ob Skaninski, who set us up on Twitter.
Well, who is still with us, let's just be clear.
Yeah, when we say late great, we mean it. Not in Long Island legal terms, where he's emerged as a titan. So he really set us up on social media. There Will Be Pod account is running in the framework that he set us up with. That account is set up to follow like movie Twitter. And movie Twitter, what I've noticed is that they focus on a movie when it comes out and then they move on, you know, within 7 days or whatever. Like for instance, like Megan that came out the first few days of January, which is really a 2023 movie with everything that thematically means. That's already what like movie Twitter, quote unquote, is speaking about. They've moved on already from, mm-hmm, you know, as you and I discussed last episode, 2022 ended for them in the beginning of December. They've already moved on. And
yeah,
that's, yeah, one way, which is very much kind of what I think of like in the, like the way TV used to work, where you would like talk around the water cooler about what the TV show was last night, like Seinfeld. That's one way of like watching movies. And the other way, which I identify with, madcap December, January catch up, where you're, the movies, mm-hmm, are becoming accessible. You make time for them. You know, you're into award season, whatnot. You want to put a cap on the year and therefore you want to do that by the end of the year. Which of those two camps are you a bit more? Is there a time in your life you were a bit more of one versus the other? Where do you fall?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely used to be like somebody who would try to see things opening weekend, especially when I was like more active writer of, mm-hmm, film reviews. Ironically, I came like Film Critics Society in 2013, I believe. And I started to get like your end of year screeners. And I think around that time, I kind of stopped trying to catch everything right when it came out. By the end of the year, I'm going to be able to,
end of the year,
if I was able to like watch something at home for free, it was maybe a little bit more appealing than rushing out, especially if it wasn't something I was like super excited about or something that I wasn't thinking that I had to see in theaters. And then the other big factor there was the MoviePass era, where when I could see unlimited movies per month or whatever it was, I was just going to see everything. And then when that kind of died away, it was just like, okay, back to normal. And then COVID, of course, and kind of changing everybody's habits at that point. So it was like a gradual slide with a few little bumps along the way. But
the world of end of year catch up, that is that camp fairly large? Or do you think it's somewhat maybe like you, me, there will be pod listeners, but I don't know if that's really representative of a much larger group of movie fans.
I suspect that people who live in New York City or Los Angeles have a much easier time seeing things like right away, end up getting an outsized influence in the conversation as a result. First person who's really into movies, which is already like a very small.
That, this is a movie fan podcast, so you know we're
yeah. But so I think, you know, if you're in a city that allows you to see this stuff, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed is this documentary that a lot of people are talking about. Is if you live in New York, you can see that in limited engagement in the one theater it's in, or you can wait until it's a little bit more widely available on a streaming platform or rental or whatever. So
yeah,
opportunity more than anything else.
I get its opportunity, but I also think there's like a time frame. Like I have a number of friends, mainly I guess referring to people in 32 Fans movie group, who they start thinking, okay, I want to see movies, I want to talk about movies in late December, January, and February. To some extent, maybe it's like awards, pop culture influence, Oscars or whatnot. But I think there's also people who just think in like an annual chronological type time frame. They don't feel the need as much in October to be thinking movies, but they start thinking movies when it gets to like December, January.
People just aren't paying attention most of the year. Movie season, like, let me turn this thing on and see what that actually is even out there right now.
It's why we do our best of the year in February. We give a time for people to stew and to people think about it and for us to catch up as well. Three movies that I think we'll be touching on in the bracket that came out and I caught up with pretty recently after they came out, and that being Batman, RRR, and Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I saw those, Batman, I think I've shared this before, but Batman I saw in the theaters the night my wife basically discovered that we were losing our child, like when we had our stillbirth. RRR, yeah, the two of us watched together 48 hours later in the hospital, like in between like the medical procedures. And then Everything Everywhere All at Once, we sort of saw while we were like mourning over the next few weeks. So those three movies, having seen them, obviously I had a very unique personal context happening with me at the time. So when I think about the movies of 2022, I can't separate Batman, RR, or Everything Everywhere from how I saw them. And that obviously—
I totally know what that's like, yeah.
Let's not get too much reflective because we have a whole episode coming up soon to reflect. Let's focus on the last 30 days.
Some of the big ones we both skipped for now, but there was a lot of big ones we both hit. John, let me suggest the following. I think there are two kind of camps you can put arguably a lot of movies this year, but certainly movies that I think we both saw in December. One camp I'll call the sort of making of the artist, or maybe the artistic aspiration, artist as a young man. And the other camp would be Eat the Rich, or Eat the Rich by Way of Murder Mystery, if I can even push it a bit further. I would put at least four titles I caught up with this month that are in the artistic aspiration group. One is Banshees of Inisherin. The next one is Armageddon Time, Funny Pages, an A24 movie. And then the last one is the Netflix's Pinocchio by Guillermo del Toro.
Mm-hmm.
I think the two of us really did a disservice to listeners when we did Fablemans last November, and we didn't manage to include Armageddon Time at the time. All four of the movies I just mentioned all have like a similar theme. But certainly, I think Fablemans and Armageddon Time are almost the same movie, just done very, very differently.
I was definitely more pro Fablemans than you were, although I wasn't like enamored with it the way that so many other people seemed to be this year. Armageddon Time is a vastly superior movie. I've been super critical almost the duration of my time as a co-host on this podcast of sort of semi-autobiographical movies about the director's childhood and how cloying I find many of them. And really, like, a lot of that just comes down to me like loathing the movie Belfast. Armageddon Time made me a believer almost that like these movies have artistic merit. It is directed and based off of, I guess, the childhood of James Gray, who, I mean, are you a James Gray fan much, Sammy?
I've been catching up since Ad Astra last year.
That was a couple years ago. I think it was before my time.
The feedback I got at the time on Ad Astra was that even though this is a crazy sci-fi Brad Pitt, it's very much a James Gray father and son type movie. I went back and I saw some of his other stuff. I saw a lot of that in this movie. You're right. I mean, this is a movie, except that the character's name is Sammy instead of James.
Paul. Sammy yeah. was Fableman.
Oh, sorry. There you go. I'm already confusing this with Fableman. There are many similarities, as you mentioned. But yeah, young Paul is young James. You know, seen some interviews with James Gray where he says, Jeremy Strong was playing his dad to a T, completely based upon him growing up in Brooklyn in a sort of racially class conscious 1980s.
I think it was in Queens.
Really in New York, though. A lot of New York themes. You like how Fablemans doesn't have any sort of social message or any sort of commentary about the
yeah. menu.
This is how this guy became a genius director, basically. Armageddon Time clearly has a broader commentary about America. I mean, the movie's referring to how the Reagan election is sort of a direct corollary to the, you know, the Trumps are very present in this movie as an inherent yeah. legacy. There's a lot of social commentary. This isn't simply like how James Gray is so amazing. If anything, I think this movie makes James Gray look like a piece of shit as a 15-year-old kid or whatever. So why do you like this despite its strong social commentary?
I was admiring the film for the first, you know, third, because I felt like this is like not trying to do too much and not trying to beat me over head with a message. If there is a message, it's kind of coming across in a way that I don't find it's lecturing me like I'm a child also, because I feel like a lot of these other movies do that, whereas because you're getting all this stuff from the point of view of a child, you're sort of getting the history or the social commentary as childlike as well, and I find that kind of stupid. So this movie wasn't doing that, and I was admiring it. And then once I sort of realized like how much that is woven into the fabric of the film, found myself rooting for it even harder, because it was like, wow, it did this thing that I have always said these movies can't do. Felt like it did it in a way that was worthy of, you know, everything that preceded it. It was not childlike in the way it's conveyed. And I felt like it was, you know, obviously really well acted.
Yeah, I thought Anne Hathaway in particular was really good. I think Jeremy Strong as the father, he was not really working for me initially. And then he had some of the best scenes as the movie developed. The
funeral, yeah, I agree.
For instance, I think he's just, it's a very powerful scene. I in general found it just a very authentic movie. The tension in the family and how that tension is taken to the extreme. Parents both communicate with their child. It just seemed very evocative, not necessarily my own childhood experience, but elements of mine and friends and sort of what I saw in the world around me. And again, I grew up, you know, 15 or so later, years later than the kids in this movie. Fablemans is getting so much Spielbergian love, and yeah. Armageddon Time really like came and went. Oh, of the two of them, certainly this is the one I think that deserves a lot more attention.
I think to an extent people want the movies like that to make them feel good. Certainly the Fablemans strives to do that. Armageddon Time really cares whether you feel
it's
good
pretty grim
or not.
Pretty
it's not like going out of its way to make you feel like depressed or anything like that, but it's uncaring in that matter.
Paul's a lazy underachiever who's at that exact annoying kind of like preteen age when, you know, you just want like the person who delivers the Chinese food to be like, here's your Chinese, you spoiled brat.
Oh yeah, whatever. Right, at some points you can really empathize with him, and other times it's hard to. You can sort of see where his struggles are coming from. The actor who played him I thought was also very good for a child actor. There's a lot of like individual scenes that I was just really impressed by, especially from an acting perspective. You mentioned a couple with Jeremy Strong that were good. I agree, Anne Hathaway was really good in the movie. I can't remember any specific scenes that I thought she stood out in necessarily. And then Anthony Hopkins is the grandpa, and all these movies have to have a magical grandpa or great uncle, I guess, in the case of the Fablemans. Yeah. But he has at least one like really, really good scene that happens with his character. It surprised me. I thought it was going to go in a different direction. I was kind of curious about that. The cast is really game. And yeah, the whole world just like feels very lived in. I thought it was really, really great.
It's a strong recommend for me as well.
Me too.
Banshees of Inisherin. This is a movie that, as much as I like Armageddon Time, I would urge, this is like everyone should see this movie as far as I'm concerned. I'm trying to think of anything like too violent or too sexual in it that would you know, scare people away.
We talked a little bit earlier about like wanting to watch some of these movies with our spouses, but other people, maybe a significant other, a good friend or whatever to talk about. I haven't wanted to watch this for a little while. I saw it was streaming on HBO, and so I was excited to see it. My wife was speaking with her dad like not that long ago and asked if there's any movies they watched, because they watch a lot of movies also. And he said, really loved The Banshees of Inisherin. He described it as reminded them of Waking Ned Divine. Have you ever seen Waking Ned Divine?
Ooh, I don't know if I've seen it, but...
Okay, so Waking Ned Divine is this... It came out probably roughly like 2001, 2002 era. And it's this comedy about two old Irishmen in like a small village. and another person who lives there wins like the lotto, and he
I have seen this yeah,
okay, yeah, so you've seen that movie. My father-in-law described this movie as like Waking Ned Divine, and my wife is like, oh, that sounds fun, like I want to watch that. We started to watch it, kind of waiting I think for the Waking Ned Divine of it all to kick in. And
back in good time,
it doesn't really go in that direction so much. Eventually talked about maybe some violent imagery, didn't get all the way through it together, and she was happy to let me finish it on my own and fill her in on how it progressed. So,
oh wow, okay.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily for everybody, but if you, as long as you don't set the expectations that it's going to be like Waking Ned Divine, then maybe anybody can get through it.
A bit of context here. What the story is, let's put the best acting of the year into this beautiful green setting in Ireland in the 1920s, in a small village on a small island. Two men in their, I suppose, 40s or 50s have their friendship fall apart, and then have a conflict emerge between what is more valuable in life. Is it the pursuit of art? And, you know, is that what you're remembered by? Or is it sort of humanism? Is it sort of being a good person? Is it sort of creativity versus humanism on some level? The relationship between two friends is also a broader commentary on human conflict as a sort of a parallel to larger conflicts that are going on in the world at the time of the movie and sort of in our own time as well. Nope, to me, still sort of sits the top of the pyramid for the most thematic elements that threw into a movie in 2022. But there's really a lot more there than just like two old guys who stop being friends, which is cute in Banshees, and that is able to sort of set it up as like a very simple premise and then just have so much more under the surface. And I think that's a reflection of the writing and the acting.
I totally agree. I mean, it starts as something kind of innocuous seeming, and it grows to very existential. It's very all-encompassing. It's so many different things, and it starts with this really kind of simple idea of what if two friends weren't friends anymore, and there's not really much more to it than that. And the fact that there's not much more to it than that is really kind of where the film gets its like dramatic heft. Ironic, like it's a great case in like not overdoing it in terms of like a screenplay or a premise. And I have to give like Martin McDonagh, who directed and wrote the film, like a lot of credit for that, because his last three Billboards, and that was like a big movie. It won like a whole bunch of Oscars. It's another movie that Belfast, I was kind of out on a limb and just hating that movie.
There's a lot of plot.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of my point, is like that movie had so much plot. It was so heavy-handed, and this movie isn't at all. It's like really deft, and it just like allows its actors to do it so much of the work for it. The setting really serves it well, that it just derives a lot of humor and a lot of humanity out of a really, really simple idea.
Colin Farrell, who's really having a year, Brendan Gleeson, Carrie Condon, who plays the sister of Colin Farrell, and you know, she is really, really strong in like a role that, her being so good in that role, is what lifts the movie to another stratosphere as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. And then the fourth kind of main character is Barry Keegan.
He was the one actor I felt was kind of not fitting in for me, at least. He seemed to be kind of just, I don't want to say overacting, but kind of just like too much, but he really
worked. I can see why you say that.
And then the second half, he really kind of clinked in, and then, you know, when he had kind of his, when he comes to the Barry character finds the stick in the very first time we meet him, and he's like very proud of it, and he's carrying it around. And then it's kind of like a scythe almost, like sort of what the devil would have. I mean, it has like a hook on the end of it. He, at some point, that it clearly belongs to that creepy old lady, because she gets it back at some point.
And yeah, Mrs. McCormick.
With it the rest of the time. And, you know, with Mrs. McCormick holding that creepy staff, like she really takes on this like banshee, you know, devil-like figure. I wasn't sure the symbolism exactly there. I mean, there's a certain obvious symbolism we don't have to spell out, right? The Barry Keegan, him getting that, him holding it, and then at some point, it's never very clear when he loses it, and then when she gets it again, at least to me, it wasn't clear when the stick transfers. But I felt there was some sort of symbolism there. Quick bit, what it was, I'm hoping to maybe keep my eye out for it the second time around. I know it's not critical to the plot, but...
Yeah.
I was curious whether that struck you as well.
Certainly, like, there's something to that, especially with, well, I think, what to imply about the Mrs. McCormick character.
Banshees of Inisherin is, of Inisherin. I should kind of practice my Irish.
Yeah, well done. You're the brogue.
It's one of my favorite. It hit me with more emotional depth than a wallop, and certainly anything else this year. To me, it's really special. It's like a movie that
I'll be watching again, and I think it'll take on a different context as I get older, because I think it does speak to different points in one's life.
I think I'd like to see it again because a few things I would kind of want to lock into a little bit more, but also how much of me responding to this is just like, I haven't responded to a new movie in a really long time in a strong way, versus this is just like really, really good. But I think it's really good. McDonough, despite my reservations about Three Billboards, I liked all of his other movies quite a bit, including In Bruges, which this one's going to remind most people love because the two leads are the same. But I think he's done a lot of good work, and I think that this is probably his best movie.
The only kind of person who I could see would be turned off is if someone was like, oh, the movie's too slow paced and it's too drawn out. I actually think the pacing really works. The music helps with the pacing and the camera work helps with the pacing. But if someone says like, oh, there just wasn't enough plot for me and it was moving too slowly, then maybe, you know, a second watch won't help. But I think for everyone else, the language and the acting and, you know, will just be fun to sort of lean back into the second time around. The other two that I put into this bucket, Pinocchio by Del Toro. It's on Netflix. Did you have a chance to catch up with it?
I haven't seen it, but I'm definitely going to see it before we close out the year.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. So I would certainly recommend it. You know, I didn't catch, I think there were like three Pinocchio cartoons that came out this year. I guess, no, one of them is the Disney live action, which people are calling now the worst Disney live action, which is quite a bar to clear.
That is another bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Among the worst Tom Hanks movie, like acting roles of the year, you know, which is.
I watched about 5 minutes of it and I was just like, nope. Yeah.
So the Del Toro is really a great time.
Yeah, I don't doubt that.
I can say the animation design is just lovely. The voice acting is really good. Geppetto, I think, is really the steals the show. He's voice acted and I guess sort of acted then by, I want to say, John Bradley in Game of Thrones. He's the head of the who has many, many bastards, and then he betrays the Starks. Spoiler. At the Twins. He's the head of the house at the Twins. So he does the voice work for Geppetto, and Geppetto really has like the key arc in this movie, much more so, I would say, than Pinocchio himself. I didn't love the movie, but I liked it and admired it. I might have admired it more than I liked it. I think the plot was a bit undercooked, particularly since it's a story that everyone sort of knows to some extent, and the theme is very heavy-handed. And then the main thing that makes me think this movie doesn't really measure up, and I think it was a mistake they did this, they include songs in the movie in akin to sort of the Disney classic. And the songs I just don't think are good. They're not memorable. I forgot all of them the moment that they finished them on screen. And I just think, given that I think maybe the best Disney, the most famous Disney songs arguably are from the original Pinocchio, like When You Wish Upon a Star and I'm a Real Boy, or, you know, what was it, even the Marvel movie?
I Have Strings or whatever.
Yeah, like I Have No Strings. Da-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah.
And some of the like classic Disney songs come from the original Pinocchio. And I think Del Toro didn't need to put music and songs into this movie. Like when they happen, they sort of, they don't seem to need to be there, but he kind of stuffs them in. Great voice cast, great animation design. Some of the roles are really special. By no means, you know, does it completely work. A movie that I think doesn't completely work, but I recommend again to everyone, particularly people who, not everyone, but to everyone who listens to this podcast, and certainly to you, John. A24 released a movie called Funny Pages. There are no actors in it you've heard of. I don't know if anyone knows the director. I don't know the name offhand, but it's similar to the whole aspiring artist. It's about a teenager and he wants to become a cartoonist, and he's living in Princeton, New Jersey, and he comes from sort of like an upper middle class background. His family's very against this. They're like, you have to finish high school, you have to go to college. And he's like, F you, I know what to do more than you. So he kind of is antagonistic toward his family. So he moves to Trenton, New Jersey, to the slums. And then he lives sort of in the slums and tries to make it on his own. And then he kind of has a rude awakening as to sort of what's in store when you try to pursue your artistic dreams. I think it has one of the best lines of the year that really speak to a lot of the movies this year. And I thought Funny Pages was funniest movie. But again, it has like what a lot of 2022 movies have, John, which is very kind of dark humor. Highly recommend A24's Funny Pages. If in case you were wondering, like, what is the A24 movie of the year? I know people are going to tell you it is what Everything Everywhere All at Once, or After Sun is what other people would say, but it's actually Funny Pages is might be the best of them. We're talking about class conflict a bit, and we're talking about dark humor.
And I think that kind of pushes me into the second camp, which I mentioned. Class criticism by way of murder mystery. Glass Onion, Bodies, 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 and The Menu.
Glass Onion was the big Netflix like release of the year, of the holiday season at the very least. And it's the sequel to Knives Out, which was this big 2019 murder mystery by Rian Johnson. The star of both movies is Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc, sort of this like...
Southern fried Sherlock Holmes. Kind of
I was gonna say like Agatha Christie style detective. Other than him, the cast of the two movies are totally unique and the settings are unique, but the vibes are very similar
and the plots are effectively the plot and the theme are basically the same, except he goes from taking down the sort of legacy rich in the first movie to now he's taking down sort of like
tech bro culture,
tech bros, or like successful entrepreneurs, I guess, entrepreneurial like wealth. Basically Elon Musk is who he's kind of targeting.
Elon Musk, I think it's important to say it's not just that he's going after Elon Musk, it's that he's going after all the systems that allow people like him to sort of thrive
and because unchecked. Because of 2022 and Twitter, and also just that so much commentary happens on Twitter, Elon Musk has become even more present in I think a lot of people's lives, meaning like Elon Musk has been sort of a demigod within Silicon Valley and tech culture for the last 10-15 years,
right?
But it's only I think the Twitter stuff which has kind of really thrust him into the center of a lot more people's conversations, and therefore then this movie kind of feeds into that a bit more. The main question I have for you, John, is what do you make of sequels that run this close to their predecessors? Meaning I knew this was going to bring back Benoit Blanc, and he actually gets a lot more FaceTime. I mean, he was kind of the protagonist,
a
minor protagonist of the first movie, which I thought was like very nicely done the way they did that. And this time he's on screen a lot more, and he probably is, I don't know, I would guess he's 40% of the lines are coming from his mouth, so he's much more present. But my question to you is, what do you make of these kinds of sequels where they're not just using the IP that the first movie has developed, but they tell pretty much the same story? Prized as I was watching the movie to be like, oh, this is literally just doing the exact same plot with the same heroine and the same dynamic as the first one. And there's a certain style of sequel where that's like the whole conceit. The conceit is you just run it back with a different milieu. So you're not playing Survivor in the desert. You're now playing Survivor on an island or whatever, you know?
I sort of feel like isn't that most sequels?
Not necessarily. I mean,
I would say that the best example of a sequel not being this is ironically the last non-Benoit Blanc movie that Rian Johnson did, which was The Last Jedi, which like took Star Wars in a totally different kind of direction to the point that infuriated everybody online. And they shat on the whole franchise.
When you mentioned Star Wars, even the original Star Wars trilogy, the second Empire Strikes Back, by no means just takes the first movie. I mean, the third movie, the third movie just has, we have a new Death Star and you have to again blow it up. But like movie, the sequel, and you could say that's different because that's like a saga that the George Lucas wrote in three parts. And so he knew he was telling like a story over three chapters. So maybe that's a different kind of sequel. But, you know, there's certainly other movies I can think of where they take the established characters from the first one, or in this case, just the one established character, I suppose, and they tell a different kind of story. I mean, Indiana Jones, just to kind of use the most obvious that jumps out. It's been a while since I've seen them, and I forget exactly what is the correct, or I guess Temple of Doom is the second one, right? But Temple of Doom is not by any means really like a one-to-one.
Yeah, but that's also a prequel, so it's kind of like,
it's set before Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's still, but I don't know. There's a lot of sequels that come to my mind. That was just the biggest one that jumped out, where I don't really feel I'm watching the same movie. And I was just surprised to the extent that it seemed that Rian Johnson was just like playing the hits. I mean, playing the hits with the sequel, I get it with Star Wars when they bring back. I mean, I didn't like this with Star Wars, and I agree with you. When they brought back Star Wars and the first of the new trilogy,
was blow up an even bigger Death Star.
Yeah, it was just like a shot for shot, plot for plot, like of the original trilogy first movie. But doing your very first sequel as sort of a theme for theme, I don't know, that to me is one of the things that I didn't like, and it struck me as kind of off base. But maybe as I kind of pointed out, like some people, why do they like Survivor? Because
they like the format and they just want to see the format with a different cast of characters in a different island. And that's what this movie does, right? So it's just like season two of Survivor, season two of Knives Out. What's not to love? Yeah,
I think that's fair. I mean, it didn't really bother me. I think that the first movie, you know, we talked in the beginning about movies that like you want to kind of recommend to people. And that's just one that, you know, I would recommend to absolutely everybody. Mm-hmm. And I sort of feel similarly about this one. Like, it's just fun. It's just a fun movie to watch. And I'm not too upset that they ran it back. I mean, there's enough surprises in terms of the plot that I wasn't really too hung up on like thematic similarities or even kind of structural similarities. It was more just like, oh, that was unexpected, or that made me laugh, or oh, that was kind of interesting, whatever. But it's just, it's a movie that's like, you know, it does exactly what it promises, and, you know, probably just better than most movies. And I think that the first one was that, and I think the second one is that.
I agree with you in that. I had a fun time. There's a lot of things I can poke holes in it, but I just had a fun time watching it. But as I think I wrote in the group as well, like, I certainly am not excited to see 10 more Knives Out. Like, I don't want to see another Knives Out every 2 or 3 years for the rest of my life or whatever it is. Like, I'd love to see the various people involved with this go off. And, you know, Rian Johnson, as you pointed out, he certainly knows how to make interesting stories in different universes. I'd love to see the people here try different things in the future, and not just to sort of get sucked into, okay, I'm now James Bond, I'm now Benoit Blanc, this is kind of my new thing. I also think that while there was a lot of like really fun small touches in this movie, and certainly no shortage of them, I felt the first movie was a much tighter. It was a tighter mystery. All the side characters were richer. There, for instance, I forget their names. I'm forgetting the name of the actor who plays them. But the blonde, kind of rich, spoiled woman in this with the personal assistant, the two of them the two of them like are not really developed like anyone else. Like, they kind of almost are not in the movie. I mean, yeah, they have a few scenes where they're partying during Corona, and then they kind of show up and they show they're spoiled, but like, they're very undercooked. And when I think back to the first Knives Out, I remember every one of the family members was very cooked, like very defined, very sharp.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think this movie, you know, if you want to compare the two, like the first one, I agree that most of the supporting cast was better developed. And I think we kind of went back and forth in the chat about this a little bit, but the supporting cast is better developed in the first, but like this sort of protagonist sidekick character from the second movie, which is in this is played by Janelle Monáe, mm-hmm. I found much more interesting and fun and had more to do than that character in the first movie, which was Ana de Armas. I thought was good in that movie, but like was kind of one note, and this one is many notes and sort of by necessity, without saying too much.
Yeah, I think the second note she has is interesting when she's kind of playing the distant, I hate all you stole my company, tough kind of cookie. That was where I was like, I hope there's a bit more there, because that's like a very bland, one note, like fakey character. And without saying much more, like, I'm glad they kind of break that apart and they show there's a bit more than what we initially get, because that wasn't working for me. If that would have been the character, I would have been like, oh, you know, rolling the eyes. I mean, I remember liking Ana de Armas's. It was kind of, there was an innocence that was necessary to the character that does emerge over the course of the movie and evolve into something a bit new. But you're right. You know, it's certainly not as complex as what we get from her, you know, new version in Glass Onion. I think the good versus bad guy vibes are also just far more overplayed here. I mean, the bad guy basically is what? Chris Evans in Knives Out, you know, to spoil that movie from 4 years ago at this point. In this movie, it's like the bad guy's very obvious. I mean, if anything, the joke is just that it's like too obvious. So how could he possibly be the bad guy if he's so obvious that he's the bad guy? But like at the same time, it's like very obvious. And the kind of the good versus bad guy vibe, the like minorities, lower class good, white, male, rich, bad. I'm, you know, we can get into this another time in another context, but I just feel this movie kind of pushes that over. Like, it just kind of like smashes you over the head with that. And where I kind of want to be like, I get it. You know, the sort of Elon Musk character, particularly in how much of a buffoon he's made himself through with Twitter, is ripe for criticism. But there's also a lot more there than, meaning people shouldn't watch this movie and go, okay, this is kind of a fair critique of a successful entrepreneur, because there's a lot more to being successful entrepreneur and a lot more to the credit, I think, of a lot of successful entrepreneurs than necessarily this movie frames it as. And so I think it's kind of a very, very broad caricature that it's targeting that I mean, I've said this in other contexts, but like there's a wonderful, really tough, strong movie, very critical. Let's basically just call it The Social Network of Elon Musk, waiting to be made about the, you know, Tesla and Twitter and all the rest of them, SpaceX, you know, entrepreneur.
I don't think that that's this movie's ultimate goal. Like this movie's ultimate
goal. I know, but a lot of people, I get it, but a lot of people were using this as like a takedown of the Silicon Valley successful entrepreneur and like the Elon Musk. And I was just being like, no, like Elon Musk is a really good like takedown movie criticism, like waiting to be made. But this by no means is that. And like, don't conflate this with that because it just, it makes this movie sound worse. And it also,
That's fair.
It unfairly tarnishes a complex figure that's worthy of a lot of criticism, but this is not the way to criticize him. I guess that's how I would put it. 2 minutes on the menu, sort of similar to me as Glass Onion. I put Glass Onion in like a higher tier in terms of enjoyment. But to me, the menu was kind of like a really fun version of those like dime novels you used to buy at the airport and like, you know, finish them up in like an hour, or you know, like those like those kind of like cheap mysteries or those cheap kind of like a little bit of sex, a little bit of violence, a little bit of like maybe a cool character that you wish maybe could be drawn out into a sequel. I think what works in the menu is basically a lot of the actors are really fun, but Ralph Fiennes, Nicholas Hoult really is playing it up like a douchebag.
He's so good. I know.
Yeah, he's really good there. Anya Taylor-Joy doesn't have to do so much. I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, but
that was right. I agree.
She's... No, I was saying Hong, the lady who plays sort of
Hong Chau, yeah.
Hong Chau is very good as well. She has a lot of subtle notes. So I think the acting in menu like makes it into a much more enjoyable, like tasty dish. Its criticisms, the plot, the ending isn't very memorable.
The ending's not memorable, really?
Yeah. I'll put it this way.
Oh my God, I totally disagree with you. I thought the ending was amazing. Well, I loved the menu.
They broadcast what's going to happen the whole time. Look, I'll put it this way. The ending of the menu is kind of the same message of Pig. And I just felt Pig did it so much better. And Pig literally came out last year. Pig basically had this same critique of like over ballyhooed food. Also sort of bringing violence into like the dining setting, and also Pig ultimately kind of the reverie or maybe like the finally cooking for love. And that's kind of what comes through at the end of Pig. I won't say what necessarily comes through at the end of Menu, but I just
the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. There's just kind of massive plot holes in the menu, but I don't care because it's just like a fun stylistic thriller that I had a good time with. But it sounds like you had a really good time with it.
Oh, I loved this movie. All the movies we've talked about so far, I really liked, and they're all going to probably end up in my top 10 list. But this is the one that's going to be the highest up. I don't know if it's going to be my number one or not, but I loved it so much. I thought it was so much fun. I loved, like you said, all the supporting characters were great. Yeah, super one note in a lot of cases. That was sort of the point. Just all the like elaborate like things that they're sort of casting onto this like motley crew of degenerates it was just really fun. I thought it was like well constructed. Like Glass Onion, kind of like set in one really elaborate place that had a lot of character. And I found like kind of traversing it all really fun and interesting. I guess part of the reason why I responded more to it is just because I really didn't know what was going to happen. And I think that Glass Onion, like, even though there are surprises, like you sort of knew, like you said, like it was fairly obvious, like what was going on here. And yeah, they've telegraphed a lot that's going to happen, but not like exactly how it's going to get there. And I felt like that was all just a delight to kind of watch it unfold.
One quick thing with the menu before we tie up. In the menu, so there's, you know, in the middle of the movie when one of the guests, you know, loses their finger, shall we say.
So I watched both Banshees of Inisherin and the menu back to back.
So you've just seen this. So you've seen the menu pretty recently. So you have a pretty sharp memory of it. Okay, so then you'll know this. So the chef calls, you know how I always prepare or we prepare for the intro to the bracket episode next month, sort of a bunch of lines for movies of the past year. It could literally just be Ralph Fiennes saying the name Margot 20 times in a row, every different time he says it with different intonation. And that could be like the best line. Like the way he says her name each time slightly differently, Margot. Like it's really, really fun. But anyways, he calls Anya Taylor-Joy back to the back of the kitchen after the guest loses his finger. And then he kind of, that's the first time when he does the whole, like, are you with us or are you with them? It's from the trailer. And in that conversation, she just says to him, like, oh, so we're all going to die. And it's just like the way she kind of jumps to that conclusion and then he like answers that. I was like, how are you just kind of assuming that at this point? Like at that point, maybe I had missed something and maybe it's more obvious. But like at that point, to me, it wasn't like clear that like that's where things were going per se, you know? Yes.
Well, I think that's part of what's fun about the movie is that like it tells you all this stuff, but you're still sort of just like,
no,
and
surely
all the characters in it are in the similar boat where it's just,
yeah,
like,
no, but okay, surely afterwards, all the characters do realize how imperiled their situation is. And it becomes like, and like, it's like very obvious. And like, then the chef is like very frontal about it. But yeah, at the time when she's called back into the kitchen after the rich guy loses his finger, at that point, like, it's just like, okay, maybe he was a douchebag. Okay. Like, it's clearly what happened with the guest and the finger is like weird. But like, yeah, at that point, I wouldn't necessarily have concluded as she says to him out loud, okay, so like everything here is going to end in a big fireball. He's kind of just,
yeah,
like, yep.
Right, right.
If they would have read back through the script afterwards, it would have been like, wait a second, maybe that shouldn't be at that. I don't know. Like something about it just rubbed me the wrong way. But yeah, I don't know. Her character certainly has like an arc in this movie, you know.
It was fun watching her kind of figure things out. And obviously, yeah, like she comes from a different place than everybody else,
yeah,
in the restaurant. And her and him kind of battle of the wills was fun. And
yeah,
and the way that Hong Chao kind of works herself into that story is interesting and fun as well. So
yeah.
I don't know. I thought all that stuff was just really, really compelling. And it has a great pace. Like it's kind of breakneck, you know, and it's just, you get these pauses of reflection on what the dish is. And like that stuff was really funny. Like I found the movie like really fun even, yeah, before it starts getting really crazy, where it's just kind of these dishes that are increasingly elaborate and ridiculous and everybody kind of talking about them pedantically. The movie could have just been that and I would have been pretty entertained. But then
I think the movie could have been Nicholas Holt just describing what he eats on.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Just like him and Janet McTeer, who plays like the editor of the magazine.
Yeah.
Like then talking about the food and being really douchey. It was just very funny.
So I will say, I think if you like The Menu, then the third movie I'd put into this camp of like social criticism by way of murder mystery. I do think first you have to catch up with Bodies, 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 which is pretty accessible.
Sure.
And I think you'll like it as well. I won't say anything about Bodies, Bodies, Bodies then. I mean, it's not saying anything. It's not a spoiler whatsoever to say it's basically like a bunch of 20-year-olds in a mansion. They start off by saying, let's play a game where we pretend one of us has died and we have to pick the murderer. And then, of course, what happens is one of them dies and they have to figure out the murderer. I think Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is the best of these three. It's better, I think, than Glass Onion and The Menu. But again, it's sort of a similar vibe, certainly. It's also a lot of class consciousness. And obviously, they're literally playing a murder mystery throughout the course, right, of the movie. So definitely recommend Bodies, Bodies, Bodies if you've missed it so far. John, I said at the top that I saw about 15 new movies. Let me give you like a sentence about the rest of them. Two more themes and then just my errata. Third theme is nonfiction. I caught up with She Said, the movie that you had shared with me last month that you had seen. I think it tells the story really well, but maybe it oversimplifies it. Maybe necessary, I don't know. And also it kind of falls into, and this is both of the movies in this camp, where there wasn't enough new there. Like I know the story of how they took down Weinstein and, you know, have a general sense, as you pointed out last time, about how like these journalistic movie investigation stories work. So there wasn't like even the sort of like, aha, the person's willing to talk. Like it felt much more of an aha moment in the, what's the name of the movie? You know, the movie about the Catholic priests in Boston.
Yeah, Spotlight.
Yeah, like in Spotlight, when they like broke the case, I remember like feeling teary-eyed and like maybe I don't feel as close in this, but like the person being willing to speak, like, and She Said they had like, they had so many stories. It was just about, could someone go a bit more on the record? And, you know, like it was all there. It was just kind of how to put the case together. It was kind of fun after watching She Said to then go and read the original article. That is like, you see them putting together and literally editing and putting in like footnotes. And then just, you can go online and like read the article from, you know, a few years ago. And then This Place Rules. This Place Rules is a validation of what John and I spoke about last month, which is that new movies come out until the last day of the calendar year. So saying you've seen the best movies, you know, on December 1st is hogwash. This Place Rules was released on December 30th or 31st. It's a documentary about sort of the hustlers and hypocrites that fueled January 6th. It's by this like young like YouTube guy who's known for making kind of zany interviews with kind of fanatics. And again, the movie, I saw this movie on January 6th, which is, I think, you know, the appropriate way to memorialize what happened. And, you know, so it certainly came out at the right time. It's
I would say like it's an important watch in that it puts it into context, but again, I didn't learn anything new. And then the movie has a very kind of like Generation Z YouTube kind of artificial style of like documentaryizing. Like they put a lot of like zoom ins on the anchor, like the guy who goes around interviewing people. Ultimately, I kind of felt that it was like Borat 2 without the craziness, without the zaniness. Like it didn't have like Sacha Baron Cohen level like ridiculousness. Mm-hmm. Not every movie needs by any means. And therefore, you know, I would say This Place Rules is like put it in your January 6th, like remember what happened that day type category. But just isn't enough there. Maybe the trailer, if it piques your fancy, like it's a movie I'd recommend. It's kind of an important movie that does show like the hypocrisy of the people behind the what happened. But there just isn't, at least for me, like I didn't feel there's anything there for so new. Two movies on World War One. The obvious one that I caught up with was All Quiet on the Western Front. Have you seen, John, the sort of legendary 1930s Oscar winning, you know, blah, blah?
Yeah, I've seen the old All Quiet movie.
Yeah, so I saw that as a kid, and I don't remember it very well. I remember the final scene. I remember sort of a few scenes here and there. I remember even as a kid, like it making a strong impression on me. I don't know if it's one of those like old-timey movies you like, or one of those old-timey movies that doesn't measure up for you.
It doesn't really, it never left much of an impression. I don't say I dislike it, but it's just kind of whatever.
So this one is the same story. The main difference is that they take advantage of modern technology to do two things. One, to make like a much more in your face, not 1917, you know, World War One intensity, but certainly like they show you the grime and the muck and the horror of trench warfare, much more so, I think, than the first one does. The 1930s movie does. And then the other thing is that they use music a lot more. There's a pounding drum score that is very, very present in this movie that... And I think it works, and it adds a lot. What doesn't work in the movie for me is that they add something which I'm pretty sure the book doesn't have, and certainly the 1930 movie doesn't have, which is they have a second story in this movie of Daniel Brühl, who it took me a second to realize who he was because he was wearing like a big mustache. But Daniel Brühl is like the one German actor everyone knows, right?
Right.
He plays like the liberal that the German generals sent him to sign the armistice with the French in 1918, 1919 or whatever to tie up the war. And so he kind of is shown trying to end the war in little clips throughout the movie. And it's trying to kind of show how, even though he's a do-gooder, all the people around him are kind of like selfish, like generals who don't care about the soldiers at the front. And therefore trying to show that contrast. And I just didn't think it needed to be pushed that far. But again, there's a lot here that's really good, and it's on Netflix. It's an easy watch, and therefore certainly if you like World War One or like movies showing kind of the horror of war, there's a lot to recommend in All Quiet. Another movie which I made sure to see, John, because I saw a number of people who I respect, critics, had it as their number one movie of the year, and that's a much more under the carpet movie called Benediction. Have you heard of Benediction? Do you sort of know
I don't line think I about? Really know anything about that no.
Benediction is a biopic of Siegfried Sassoon, who was a famous British poet in World War One. He was a gay poet. He wrote about his experience as a soldier in the trenches, and he died in like the 1967, you know, so like he wrote most of his stuff in the 20s and then, you know, I guess kind of lived off that legacy for the decades that followed. I thought this movie was terrible. I went in like very even-handed, you know, I'd read about it being some people's number one of the year, etc. The movie just doesn't work on any number of levels. It expects the audience to be deeply familiar with Siegfried Sassoon, who I don't think most people are. You have to know who all of his close circle of friends are, and I don't think most people know that. And it provides you no context as to sort of who his friends are, how successful he was. At no point in the movie does he seem to ever really be under pressure or threat. Even like when he's shot in the war, it's just like a flashback that kind of cuts away immediately. I just kind of found it bland and unmotivated storytelling. It's by a very famous British director who I'm not super familiar with. You may be a bit more than myself, but I wouldn't recommend Benediction, unfortunately. The only kind of recommendation for it is that it weaves the poetry of Sassoon throughout the movie, and most of his poetry is about World War One, and it does do that well. So listening to poems about the horror of the trenches after having recently seen All Quiet on the Western Front, it kind of made the two movies work in hand with each other. But otherwise, I would say Benediction is an easy miss. A few movies I really like, though. Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. John, you got to see it.
I will.
It's really fun. You know, maybe it can tie in a bit to like The Menu, because suffice to say, this is a movie. I don't know if you know the name of the actress who's deservingly winning a lot of credit for this. It's a movie about a lady in her 60s whose husband has died. She's a widow. And so she hires a male prostitute to sort of help her have an orgasm. And she's like a proper British matron in a small town. And he's this kind of like, you know, guy who's doing this on the side to sort of make do. And the two of them just end up having long conversations, really. What I found this was, John, I was thinking of you a lot, is that this was also clearly a Corona movie. It's like the two of them in a hotel room wearing robes speaking to each other. And he's black, the prostitute, and she's white. And I don't know if you know what movie I'm talking about. What movie came out this year that you particularly liked, which was mainly sort of a story of two people who have emotional attachment, and she's like a white woman in her 40s and 50s, and he's like a younger black man, and they're both wearing robes and they're sitting and talking in a hotel room?
Oh, 3,000 Years of Longing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I haven't heard anyone compare this to 3,000 Years of Longing, but I had that very much on my mind. Again, besides the fact of what I framed, they have no real similarity. Again, I mean, there's also a certain like sexual element pervading both movies, but I really like Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. I think it's really good and I would recommend it. Baby Assassins, it's just a really fun movie. It's about it's a Japanese movie. It's about two Japanese late, like 20-year-old assassins who work for some kind of secret society that sends them off to like kill mostly like feels like gang members. The two leads are sort of fun. They're very endearing. It's a certain humor that either will work for you or work for me, or maybe, you know, at some point it maybe get to it, it'll get annoying. The action scenes, like you would expect, are really, really, really well done. I think the third act, the finale, I didn't really like go for so much, but it's a movie that's just it's a lot of fun. And it's probably more similar to other movies of its kind that I haven't seen, because I don't watch that much like Japanese, you know, or like in general, like East Asian kind of action movies. But Baby Assassins, I would recommend as well.
Yeah.
And finally, like, whatever you do, do not see White Noise. That's all I got. Do not see White Noise.
I did already see White Noise.
Oh, no.
And I was watching it, and I was just like, I don't even know if I'm going to mention that. Watch this.
I don't even know what, like,
I was definitely not going to recommend you check it out.
Oh no, I'm going to anti-recommend it. It's important to like tell people what to avoid, just because I saw almost only movies I liked. It's important to mention that, like, White Noise, I saw a small Italian movie called The Hole, which was not, which I recommend not seeing. So do not go see The Hole. But let's go back to White Noise. John, what I don't understand about White Noise is that the script was one of the worst parts, and this is based upon an award-winning famous novel. So presumably most of the script is lifted from the book. I just felt they spoke to each other in such a fakey clipped tone of voice. I don't know. I didn't know what the movie was trying
to do. Yeah, they did.
I don't know. The complete miss.
I had a hard time with it as well. I mentioned in the chat, somebody who said they watched and couldn't quite wrap their head around it. And I was like, I think, and it's probably to the point that it was based off of this like really well-regarded novel, but I was like, I think there's a good movie in here. I just have no interest in rewatching it, trying to figure out what that is.
I think you can make a good movie maybe based upon the bones of what the story is. I don't think this movie has anything to salvage, though. I don't think there's anything there. Like to me, it's a complete miss. What a weird, like, I also think that Baumbach's, you know, he's had, I think, a few misses for me, at least. Like, some of his earlier stuff I really don't like so much. I find also the script there is a bit stilted. I really like Marriage Story. And so I came into...
I don't like Marriage Story either.
Oh, I came into this with the best of intentions. Obviously, I was all ready to go, but the movie was not ready to go for me. John, unless you have anything, do you want to give us a classics corner as we get ready to even more catch up high up the year?
Chatting with a friend of the pod, Zach Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's starting a new ladder over at the Movie Ladder podcast with him and mm-hmm. Brendan. He also mentioned to me that they are doing a sort of a challenge for the year of watching a variety of different movies that fit different criteria. And I always try to like follow along with those over the course of the year if I can. First category that came up, they're doing one every 2 weeks, which I think is a little bit more manageable than one a week. So I was excited about that. But the first category was a movie that features a performance that was nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars historically. So I watched for the first time a movie that has not one but two Best Actress performances in it, including a winner It was also the Best Picture winner of its year. It's Terms of Endearment. It came out in 1983, directed and written by James L. Brooks. It was his first movie. And the best actresses that year was Shirley MacLaine, who won the award, and then Deborah Winger, who was nominated. It's a good movie. I didn't love it. Reputation is that, like, yeah, it was this phenomenon when it came out, but maybe doesn't really stand the test of time as well. I think I kind of felt that for sure. I think the acting was good, if that was sort of the point, was to watch these actresses nominated for awards. They were good. I definitely prefer Broadcast News if you want to watch a really good James L. Brooks movie from the 80s.
You know, if you wanted to see, John, a movie with several award-winning, Oscar-winning female stars, you could have seen Del Toro's Pinocchio on Netflix, because Cate Blanchett and Tilda Swinton are both in the movie.
Yeah, but their performances aren't nominated for Oscars, which was sort of the...
I mean, not yet, but, you know, give it a month or so.
I don't think that that's happening, but that would be wild.
No, I would love if Tilda Swinton and Blanchett for Pinocchio sweep the awards. But because you really have to, like, you have to really, really pay close attention in the Pinocchio movie to know where Cate Blanchett appears. Well, what I read is that she basically told Del Toro, like, I love you and I love Pinocchio, like, get me in your movie somehow. And so he managed to push her into the movie, but not in a way you'd expect. Okay, cool. I will take your anti-recommend for that classic. And mine is a bit more of a deep cut. Earlier today, I read a short story called Stories of Your Life by the excellent Ted Chiang. And do you know what Stories of Your Life is connected to vis-a-vis movies?
Not sure.
And as I was reading it, I was like, man, this is so similar to Villeneuve's Arrival from, what is it, 2016.
Oh, and okay, yeah.
Googled, like, Stories of Your Life. And, of course, Stories of Your Life is the source material. The book, it was a short story that was published in, I think, 2002 or 3. Everyone who read it was like, oh, wow, this is going to be impossible to make into a movie. And they're very, very different. The emotional beat and the basic, like, structure is the same as Arrival. But Arrival's clear. It's just really interesting. First off, it's a wonderful short story, as you would imagine if you sort of like Arrival, which I love. Read Stories of Your Life. And then maybe go back and watch Arrival, which I want to do now. This short story became that movie.
Sounds good.
Tentatively, we'll try to connect this January, do an episode on maybe Avatar, Babylon, Women Talking, maybe The Whale. And then we'll also sort of put together the bracket in the episode. I'm going to bring my 32 or so favorite. You're going to bring your 32 or so favorite. And we'll hash out like the bottom 10 that maybe we have to disagree who should get who's in, right?
Looking forward to it.
Speak to you soon.
We were a king once. Can we be king twice? We were bathing in milk, played for diamonds and silk once. But we want it twice. My show was a magnet for the crowd. No one could resist Wolper's crown. Now the little ones. Now the married ones prefer Garbo, Gardel, Valentino, La Voce di Caruso, jazz on the radio.